Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight, I'm speaking with one of this year's recipients of the MacArthur Fellowship, also known as the MacArthur Genius Award. Sujatha Baliga is an attorney and the director of the Restorative Justice Project at Oakland-based Impact Justice, an organization dedicated to justice reform through innovation, research, and policy ideas. Sujatha has been honored for her work as a restorative justice practitioner. She's developed a program in Alameda County focusing on diverting youth who have been convicted of felonies and other crimes out of our criminal justice system and into mediation. She now focuses her efforts on applying restorative justice strategies to help heal survivors of sexual and intimate partner violence. Sujatha joins us tonight to discuss how survivor-centered restorative justice interventions can reduce mass incarceration, violence, and recidivism. Welcome and congratulations, Sujatha.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation, and we're going to open the phone lines up in just about 20 minutes. But you can dial to ask questions and join this conversation at the number 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Well, Sujatha, I have to start with a question about the Genius Award. How did you find out that you received this really prestigious honor?
So I received a phone call, and it was actually a scheduled phone call. I had met the director a few months earlier, and I think she'd set up the ruse by asking me I think in the past the fellowship had the experience that they could call people and people would just pick up the phone maybe 20, 30 years ago. But, you know, today it's people don't pick up numbers they don't. So now there's more ruse kind of things that they do, I think. So I happened to meet the director in passing and she had given me her card and said she'd like to know people who I find, you know, to be doing good work in the field. And so I'd kicked her an email and then several months later she said, I'd like a follow-up call with you. And I thought, well, I don't think this is the way their process works, but okay, I'd happily talk to this person about, you know, people I think should be on her radar. And so when I got the call from her, she said, you know, we're not calling today to talk to you about anybody on your list. And I thought, oh my goodness, like I'm not prepared to talk about it. And so it turned out that she was saying we're calling to say congratulations. You know, we're calling to talk to you about someone named Sujatha Baliga is what she said, which was, I was actually initially quite confused. And so my husband joked later when I relayed the story to him, he said, not so genius.
Well, that must've been a very pleasant phone call to get. A good thing you didn't block the caller. As you mentioned, it sounds like they've maybe had that issue before. So for those who are not familiar with the Genius Award, can you just describe briefly what the award will allow you to do?
Well, what's amazing about the award really is that it's a personal award that allows you to do whatever you think you need to do with it, right? And so I've heard that fellows have used the money to do anything, whether it's apply it to the work that they're doing or paying off student debt, which is surely something that I will be doing with the first several payments. Doing what it is that allows your life to open up so that you can be more creative, that you can take your work in new directions that you might not have had the capacity to do. I think what's most beautiful about the award is that it's not a lifetime achievement award, right? It's more about what will you do if you don't have these financial burdens, right? So that's and what kind of new creative directions might your work go?
So, really giving you space to grow, and you and other geniuses who have received the award. So that's very exciting. So all right, well, let's talk about what you received the award for. Let's talk about restorative justice. Can you describe for listeners what that means?
Sure. So one of my mentors in the work is a man named Howard Zare, and I really love the way that he's framed restorative justice. He wrote one of the seminal texts in the field called Changing Lenses, and I can't remember if it's in that text or another one, in which he first poses this thing called the three questions. And so this paradigm shift that restorative justice calls us to is really about a very different way of looking at crime and harm and wrongdoing and even conflict. So instead of asking the kinds of questions like, after something has gone wrong, what law was broken or what rule was broken, who broke it, and how should they be punished, restorative justice asks a very different set of questions. It asks, who was harmed, and what do they need, and whose obligation is it to meet those needs? And there are additional questions that restorative justice asks, like what were the causes, you know, and who all has a stake in this situation, and who should come together to help come up with how do we operationalize getting those needs met, right? That's the paradigm shift restorative justice calls us to. And so it can look a number of different ways in practice. But at base, what it does is that it calls family and community together to wrap around both the person who's caused harm and the person who's experienced a harm, ultimately, ideally coming together in order to come up with a consensus-based plan in which, you know, the harms are addressed and that people are held directly accountable to the person who they've harmed and their self-identified needs.
And does this always take place within the sort of formal institution of our criminal justice system, or could it also take place on the civil side or maybe outside of our formal legal processes?
I think it takes place every day when you think about it. I mean, it's there's so many things that we see in the world where we could name restorative justice, right? I think about sort of the situation where a young person throws a baseball through a neighbor's window, and if, you know, their parents know the neighbor, they might take their kid, you know, over there and look them in the eye, make them apologize, encourage them to apologize, rather, and find out how much it costs and then, you know, help the kid get a job to pay them back. I mean, that could be called restorative justice, right? It doesn't require, you know, a formal setting and facilitation. I think that it can happen in relationship to the system. But I think it operates at its best when it's really something that becomes a part of the culture of our society and our families and our communities to say, how do we support folks to be directly accountable to the people that they've harmed? We see it happening every day.
Well, and along those lines, in terms of culture, what are the origins, as you see it, of this model of restorative justice?
So my belief is that if we went far enough back in any of our cultures, we would find this kind of process, right, before we had official courts and processes. But you can see sort of what feel very close to what we call restorative justice in a lot of different indigenous people's peacemaking practices. Sort of independently of that, again, Howard Zaire, who's Mennonite, there are a lot of Mennonite folks who think deeply about what Howard called covenant justice in his first text on this. And it really is looking far enough back in your community to say, what does it mean to be in right relationship? And so what processes can we create in order to be in right relationship? Or what another one of my mentors, the former Chief Justice of the Navajo Nation, Robert Yazzie, says, you know, moving forward in a good way. So these are the kinds of things that we can see in so many cultures. Maori from Aotearoa, New Zealand, folks there have been doing things that we would call restorative justice now. But those aren't words that they originally applied to what it is that they do.
It's
right?
Just the way they resolve disputes.
Yeah, right? It's just the way of being in right relationship with one another.
Well, do you think a lot of that is a function of just the population size? I mean, if you're in a small village of, say, 200 people, you have to coexist. When there's a wrong that's done, there is no prison to send someone to. There's no sort of institution. And now we've gotten to the point where we've sort of made this very depersonalized. Do you think that's part of why we've strayed from that indigenous model?
It might be, but all indigenous models aren't necessarily non-punitive, right? So we hear about different, historically different indigenous peoples also having exile as a part of this. So I hate to like, I don't want to, you know, sort of elevate all past ways of doing things as being like this necessarily non-punitive. But I do think that our not knowing our own neighbors' names, which is something that is unfortunately true in modern society, can lead to us feeling more comfortable with the notion that we could send someone far away or put them in a cage as a way of solving something. When we aren't in deep relationship, we're not going to care about, you know, that young person or that adult or their families or communities in the way in which mass criminalization impacts folks today.
And so what's the status right now of restorative justice? It seems like an area that there's obviously a lot of interest and enthusiasm for. Where is this happening? Kind of how do you see this? Is this on the ascendancy? Where are we in terms of the overall status of restorative justice as a movement?
Yeah, its ascendancy is happening in all kinds of different settings and contexts, right? So definitely schools have been an amazing place in which people are trying to introduce restorative approaches to not just addressing harm, but even primarily building community and building a sense of shared values in classrooms, young people's capacity to talk about what's going on in their lives, et cetera. And then ultimately, you know, in some smaller percentage of situations being used to resolve conflict and even more serious infractions that restorative justice can play itself out there. We're seeing it in both the youth context in terms of more serious things that happen both inside and outside schools and even in adult contexts. And people are applying restorative principles inside prisons and in different places in relationship to the criminal legal system as it currently operates. My personal feeling is that the more it operates at the family and community levels, independent of those kinds of structures that are inherently binary, separating, punitive, when that hammer is hanging over people's heads, it's harder to do the real work of restorative justice, which is to really come clean about everything that's going on in a situation. So it's sort of the threat of criminalization can really erode what restorative justice can be at its best. But restorative things, restorativeness can play itself out in many, many different contexts.
And so to the extent that this is happening in these formal criminal justice institutions, are there certain states that seem to be leading? Is this something that courts can sort of do on their own? What are the sort of legal mechanisms and the jurisdictions that seem to be taking the lead on this?
Well, our work at Impact Justice, Ashley George is the Associate Director of the Restorative Justice Project in relationship to all the youth diversion work. And she's working, and my team is working in several jurisdictions across the nation. And our work is really on the pre-charge side of things. So we actually want this all to happen without ever hitting the courthouse doors, without people being assigned a public defender and a probation officer. And so we're working in places like Nashville and Miami and Philadelphia and several jurisdictions inside and communities inside California, many locally here in San Francisco, in Richmond, California, and Oakland, Alameda County. And there are more that are popping up all the time. We get constant requests, particularly with this wonderful new wave of progressive district attorneys who are invested in diverting cases before they are charged. And that is the line that we draw with the work that we're doing. That being said, there are other restorative justice programs that operate that people talk about, restorative justice courts and restorative justice sentencing circles. And there are programs where people plead guilty with the understanding that they're going to be participating in restorative justice process. It's our orientation to stay sort of ahead of all of that. In the youth context, but ideally working in the adult context and starting to look at young adults who are technically adults, but then also ultimately working in the adult context as well. That's our trajectory.
Well, this is helpful, just context of kind of where we are with this movement back towards restorative justice. But let's try to get a little more detail on how the process works. I mean, you described it a bit at the opening, but can you just walk us through maybe a typical restorative justice process so people can really imagine how this plays out?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So when we talk about specifically San Francisco as the program is currently operating today, so young people who commit certain felonies are eligible, like let's say burglaries or certain robberies, and I believe it's first and second time offenders at this time, after being arrested, they are, rather than being, again, charged with the crime, being assigned a probation officer and going to court, et cetera, if they commit these certain types of crime, they're automatically eligible for restorative justice, right? And so...
And that's by law?
That is by the decision of George Gascon, who was the district attorney, right, who and his team set up this program. And we worked together for several months. First, we did listening sessions across the county and the city, asking folks, well, what would they like to see the program look like? What are the natural supports that exist within the community? What types of organizations are invested in this happening, et cetera? We did focus groups with youth, et cetera, and we sort of built this program based on the wisdom of all these folks here. And then with George Gascon and the DA and his staff really helped us develop this program. And so the charging district attorney decides that that case is would have been something that they would have charged. It's a felony. But then at the time, the capacity by the community-based organization that was facilitating those cases, that organization's named Community Works, and they're working with Huckleberry House, those organizations didn't have the capacity to take all eligible cases, and so they would randomize the cases into restorative justice. So they would the computer would roll the dice about whether or not young people would get the case. So all of those cases are eligible. The DA didn't want to cherry pick. They wanted to make sure that they weren't just picking the ones that look like the good cases, and they wanted to make sure that there was no discrimination that can come from DA discretion.
So randomizing it, you thought was a good idea?
I thought it was a brilliant idea, because when we don't randomize, what happens? Ideally, what we would have is enough money for every every eligible case to go to restorative justice, right? And that the community-based organizations that is doing this work would have been funded well enough to do all the cases. But since that wasn't possible, it was a wise thing to not just have the charging district attorney say this case, this case, this case. And so those cases go to that set of cases goes to the Restorative Justice Organization, which is Community Works West, and a facilitator there then reaches out to the young person who has been arrested for this situation, right? And they meet with that young person, and they have a conversation with them about from a strengths-based perspective, we know you picked up this case, but we're here to help you, and we believe in you. And so we start to, work with that young person to help them understand that they're capable of making this thing right, and that, we're not against you, we're not the bad guy, right? And then when working with that young person and getting them ready to take responsibility for what they've done, also reaching out to the person who's been harmed and asking them the questions that I mentioned before, like, how are you harmed, and what do you need? And through that conversation, often that person who's experienced the harm starts to ask questions like, well, who did this? And where's my stuff? And, and at that point, it's a really good time to say, well, there's a possibility of you meeting that young person and having a conversation. Would you be interested in doing so?
And these are all just burglary crimes.
Burglaries, robberies, some assaults.
Some of these harms are very personal in nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And they should be, because restorative justice works best under those circumstances, right? And so ultimately, with the consent and interest of everyone involved, the parties come together with supporters on both sides, right? So the young person who's caused the harm, were ideally if the parents, guardians, and as well as others, friends, uncles. One time we had like a second grade teacher from years ago come and support the young person to be responsible. And then the person who's harmed also should have supporters as well, people who understand the impact of this crime on them, and really just being there for them, so it doesn't feel like it's a bunch of people against the person who's experienced the harm. So then ultimately they come together and they have a dialogue about what happened and what needs to happen moving forward. And then at a certain point there's a pause, and people eat together, and then they come back together and they come up with a plan to repair the harm. The young person and their parents, if they have parents involved in their lives, come up with a first draft of the plan sort of outside the room, and then come back and the young person presents it to everyone. And then there's a consensus-based process where this plan, which involves four parts, doing right by the person you've harmed first and foremost, and then your parents or guardian, doing right by the community, and in some ways, most importantly, doing right by yourself. Like, what is going on in your life that you went down this road, and what do you need in order to not have that happen again? So when that plan is completed, then no charges are ever filed. And in Alameda County, we kept track of victim satisfaction, and we saw a 91% satisfaction rate. And that was measured in a few different ways, including if you were ever victimized again, would you prefer restorative justice to court? And so 91% said yes. And the same number said that they would recommend this to a friend if their friend had something happened to them. So,
and do you know how that satisfaction rate compares to the satisfaction rate for the existing criminal justice system?
Wouldn't it be great if the existing criminal legal system kept track? So one of the there's an article by someone by the name of Nils Christie from like the 1970s who wrote an article called Conflicts as Property, and it traces the history of how our crimes really weren't crimes originally. Like, everything was civil. And at a certain point, the crown in England realized that those were really lucrative situations going through court, right? Like, if you murdered someone, the restitution or the repair on that was a lot of cash or whatever, right? And so that's how the idea of a criminal court developed, that the crime became against the state instead of between two people. And so, in a sense, the state stole our harms. When we, as survivors, it's the people versus so and so, right? Or the state versus so and so. It's not me versus the person who harmed me. And I'm not a fan of the notion of versus. But even if we are going to do versus, why am I, if I'm somebody harmed, not party to the situation?
Well, I want to talk about the people who have been harmed. Are they usually willing participants in this? I mean, is it hard to get them to want to sit down across a table from someone who, may have really created a very traumatic situation for them. What are some of the responses and motivations on the part of those?
So I can speak. Yeah, I can speak to myself and my own sort of experience with it. In the first 25 or 30 cases that I did before I stopped actually facilitating cases and got more involved in the implementation aspect of this, I did about 25 or 30 cases myself. And in my experience, I only had one victim say that they didn't want to participate at all. And another person said that they wanted somebody else to sort of be their surrogate, but not be in the room. They were happy with the, with somebody. They wanted to choose the person who was going to go ahead. And I think that, I spent a lot of time thinking about, why was I successful? And I think it really was because I didn't push the program. So I think when you come to this work in restorative justice, if you come with the agenda that the thing should result in a dialogue, then victims will feel pressured. But if you really stop and ask those questions in a meaningful way, how are you harmed? What do you need? What do you need to see happen? Like, what's been the impact? And take a lot of time building that trust and relationship, then I suspect that far more people would participate than we've seen in data, across the nation with different types of programs.
All right. Well, I have a lot more questions about the process, but I want to just let listeners know that this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing restorative justice with 2019 MacArthur Genius Fellow and Director of the Restorative Justice Project at Impact Justice, Sujatha Balaga. We invite you to call in with questions or comments, and we're opening the phone lines now. The number to call and join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page as well. We want to hear from you. If you have a loved one or you yourself have had an experience with restorative justice that you'd like to share, and we're particularly interested in what the outcome was, we'd love to hear from you. Again, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, Sujatha, let's go back to discussing the process here. So can you talk a little bit about what kind of prep has to go into these meetings, both on the part of those who are directly involved, the person who was harmed, the person who inflicted that harm, but then also for, folks like yourself and on your team who are managing this process?
Mm. So I'll start with people who've experienced the harm, right? I mean, the preparatory work really is about deep listening. I mean, that's true on all sides, including amongst co-facilitators, like how deeply we listen with no judgment and with compassion while people tell us what their experience with the situation was. And so that's a large part of the relationship building that we have to do in the beginning so that people feel that they can trust us to help create the container in which they can have that direct dialogue. Really with the person who's experienced the harm sometimes, and especially if there's somebody who's been victimized many times, or maybe this is a burglary we're talking about here, but it's bringing up a feeling of violation that now is causing them to relive some much more severe trauma that they experienced in their childhood, et cetera. We have to really slow down and listen and be present for whatever it is that they need to say to us. And sometimes really help them inventory, what was the impact on this and what might you need to see happen, especially for folks where nobody's ever asked them before, what do you need? I mean, it's hard to identify that, right? And so it's being patient and really just and sometimes being not too directive, and I really like to leave things open to survivors to guide the situation. But sometimes, you have to think, were there fiscal harms, or were there financial harms, or was there material loss, or was there what would you want to say to this person? What do you need to hear from this person? What do you what's the most well if and if they tell us needs that they have that we know might not get met, we ask these questions. Would you still want to participate in this process?
And are there typical responses that you get to these kind of questions, or the typical things that the survivors request and would like to see happen?
I would have to say no. Every single case is different. And I think this is why it's so beautiful in relationship to you know, the criminal legal system, which has pre-existing options, right, that the state will do to the person. I've seen such incredibly varied things from, you know, wanting someone to, you know, work to pay them back or, you know, return the thing lost to, well, one person wanted a really humongous picture of Tinkerbell painted on canvas for her. And it was just, I mean, and that was in a car theft case. Like, I mean, you just really never know what's going to happen. And that's really one of the most beautiful things. And so, yeah, so it varies. And then in terms of preparation with the person who's caused the harm, you know, again, accountability is not easy. And to remove shame from the situation and to come from a strengths-based place where we believe in you to be able to fix the thing that you did, and it's going to feel yucky and it's going to be hard, but we're right here for you and to support you to do this. And sometimes there's a little bit of, like, education in a sense, but not heavy-handed, right? Like, so we don't come with, like, a pre-existing curriculum where we're sort of educating folks. Rather, it feels really important for us to say, well, if you heard that, you know, if somebody's not taking full responsibility in the preparatory meetings and you say, well, somebody did that to you and that's what you heard, how would that land on you? Or if that happened to somebody in your family and you heard that person say, well, you know, it wasn't really that bad or whatever, you know, how do you think that would feel to them? And so really helping people just starting to stretch the empathy and understanding of the impact of their behavior before walking into that room. But more than anything, those preparatory meetings are about creating the container that involves family and community on both quote-unquote sides and making sure that all those folks are on board too and that all of them understand what is this process about. This is about moving forward in a good way. And so how do we make sure that everyone who's coming into the room really understands their role and that this is not about humiliating anyone or in any way, that this is about all boats rise with the tide, and how do we do that collectively?
And what's the role of those you described, often family members? What role do they play? What's some of the things you've seen happen with their role in the process?
It's really beautiful sometimes seeing folks talk about the impact of the harm and feeling the validation for the person who's experienced the harm, sometimes from family and community and friends, supporters on the side of the survivor who didn't understand how much people cared about them. Sometimes you see support coming from the parents of the person who's caused the harm or them really just reaching out across and helping build that bridge. And just a lot of offers of connection and offers to help the young person make the thing right. That we see a lot of that role. But really it's to witness and to, you know, to bear witness and to help people feel like, you know, they're not alone. And crime, even when it's something small, can be really isolating. People need to have what happened to them be witnessed. And I think on the part of folks who've caused harm, right, when I can be honest with people and when everyone can see what I've done wrong and give me support around changing my behaviors and fixing the situation, that's a really beautiful opportunity to truly feel what unconditional love is. It doesn't mean that accountability doesn't go hand in hand with that, but rather that when I show you sort of the underbelly of who I am, you're still willing to sit in the fire with me. That's a really beautiful role that people play.
And what's the sort of timeline on this? You mentioned people sit and eat. Is this usually just a sort of morning and a lunch? Is this a full day, multiple days?
Ideally, it happens in like 2 to 3 hours. It can happen pretty quickly. There's definitely a pause, again, where people break bread together. And that's a really important thing because hungry people can be angry people. And so you also just don't want to like drive the thing into the ground. Like there's overprocessing. And so people need a pause. But ideally, you get through the whole process where the harm is excavated, the truth is told, responsibility is accepted, a plan is produced, and a consensus happens within like 2 hours.
And the food, do you bring that in or do they have to agree on the food?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It depends. Like one time I was working on a hate crime that happened in a mosque and we had to make sure that all the food was halal, you know, so like that kind of thing can happen, right, where you want to just be thoughtful about people's dietary needs and restrictions and where it's going to be, what kind of space it's going to be in, where's it going to be held, and really also, again, rebalancing things by making sure that all the parties, but particularly the person who's experienced the harm, gets to choose all of those things instead of having to go to a courthouse that was not designed on the basis of trauma that's been experienced, but rather trying to be in spaces where it's going to be attendant to everyone being their best selves.
And you mentioned there's a plan that comes out of this, so I assume you would write up the plan, but then who makes sure that this is actually enforced?
Yeah, the facilitator of the restorative justice process does. In San Francisco, it's a bifurcated role, and I think that that's a really good way to do it. So Huckleberry House folks who work there monitor the plan. We call it the agreements manager, and that person sort of sees the plan through. And there's really minimal communication back to the district attorney's office, but sufficient for them to feel confident that the thing is moving forward. So a really important aspect of the program is that there's a memorandum of understanding with the district attorney's office that says nothing that's said in a restorative justice process can be used in a court of law. And so when we tell young people this, you can tell me anything. It's sort of the opposite of Miranda warnings, in a sense, right? Miranda warnings, we say anything you say can and will be held, be used against you in a court of law. That would make, any smart person shut up at that point, right? But we tell people who've caused harm the opposite, right? That you can tell us anything about what happened here, and we're not going to tell the DA. We're not going to use this against you.
A key feature there in terms of getting people sure to be more open. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. And we're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing restorative justice with 2019 MacArthur Fellow, who just won the Genius Award from the MacArthur Foundation. And she's a director of the Restorative Justice Project at Impact Justice, Sujatha Balaga. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page, and our Twitter perch is at cityvisionskalw. We want to hear from you. What are your hopes or concerns about restorative justice? Do you have questions or comments for Sujatha? We'd love to hear from you. Again, it's 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Well, Sujatha, I wanted to ask about the agreement that we were just talking about a second ago that folks who are involved in this process end up signing. Are there penalties for noncompliance if the agreement, the person on the other end of this isn't holding up their end of the bargain?
So in those circumstances in which the case is diverted by the district attorney, right? So we work with the young person as best we can to get them everything that they need in order to be accountable, right? But if the case isn't completed, if the young person drops out of the program, if, things of that nature, then, we just tell the district attorney that the case wasn't completed. And then they can do whatever they were going to do, right? And so, I would suspect, given particularly in San Francisco, that when a case they had planned to charge that case anyway. These are felonies. So if the process doesn't work out, then the DA is going to do what the DA was going to do in the first place. And so we see ourselves as a system circumvention process. And if people don't want to participate or don't complete, then there's, then it's going to do what it does.
And are there any crimes or maybe types of people who would not be eligible? Restorative justice is just not an option.
This is a program that is and a process. That is about accountability, right? And so, the way we do our work is again in a pre-charge context, in lieu of the system. So, if somebody doesn't want to take responsibility or participate, then it's that simple. It's like whoever wants to be accountable and make things right, then they are. And I don't think that there are any crimes that are ineligible. Quite moved and excited about the fact that our new district attorney in San Francisco said that, any survivor who wants restorative justice should be able to have it. I mean, we haven't worked out the details of in what posture, but I think that that is a wonderful aspiration. And so we're going to be working hard to build the capacity in order to make that true.
Well, you're mentioning that there's not enough money for all these disputes and crimes and other harms to be addressed through restorative justice, but wouldn't this save a lot of money? Do we have any data on how much this saves? Because otherwise, they're going to go into the court system. I know it's a different pot of money, but Has that analysis been done?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, we have preliminary analysis on this. It varies county by county, right? And so in some counties, it costs – the cheapest it is to incarcerate a child for a year in the entire state is $140,000 a year, right, with restorative justice. So what I think is a really powerful set of information. And D.A. Gascon recently published a report that showed that the young people who go through the program here in San Francisco have a 13% recidivism rate, 1-3. Young people and the kids who are randomized, so because it was randomized, we could do a randomized control trial, right? And so the young people who are charged with a crime, just charged with a crime, 53% recidivism rate. So 13 to 53. And so the cost savings there are also astronomical, right? So we have older data out of Alameda County that shows that just having a probation officer for a year cost $22,000 per kid. And again, in upwards of, you know, nearly $500,000 to maybe $400,000 to have a kid locked up. In that county. And so this is, you know, the cost of restorative justice, you know, maximum $10,000 to go through this program, and significantly cheaper in certain places, or certain cases just move a lot faster. And so, you know, the cost savings are astronomical. And when you say they're different pots of money, I mean, I think that doesn't have to be the case, right? We could be downsizing the criminal legal system as we know it and redirecting what we think of as prison waste, really, in a sense, towards funding restorative justice programs.
Well, it's also the court processing time, right? All of it involved.
The district attorney time, the public defender time, all of that time could be the probation department, not just running the facilities, et cetera, but all of that would be saved.
So this is an alternative to incarceration, but do some of the folks who have been harmed, do they want the perpetrator to go to jail? I mean, is that an issue that you've come across with this process? Because it seems like it's not an option, right, with restorative justice. They're not going to jail.
Right. Well, I think what's really interesting is my friend Danielle Sarad has this beautiful – she runs a program in New York called Common Justice, and it's a restorative justice program there that works with crimes of violence. And, you know, she has this beautiful analogy, which is about if you see a bunch of people, you know, in the desert who've been starving and there's a hamburger truck there – and everyone's lined up to eat at the hamburger truck in the desert who are starving to death. You know, you can't say that this is the best hamburger truck in the desert. You can't say that none of those people are vegetarians, right? I mean, I'm a vegetarian. I would be lined up at the hamburger truck, right? And so I think the thing with most crime survivors is that they've only been offered one vision of accountability, and that is to do something bad to the person or lock that person up. And so when we actually gently educate folks who've experienced harm about what the criminal legal system has on offer and give them options through restorative justice for what they actually would define as success in their situation. If we do that in a thoughtful and caring way, then crime survivors generally come around to restorative justice, right?
And you mentioned over 90% are become very happy with this process. But of those who weren't happy with how it turned out, was there any common complaints?
So we haven't fully disaggregated that data, but generally speaking, it was because the process didn't complete, right? The young person didn't complete the plan to repair the harm. And so that was very few cases, and those people were generally not satisfied, right? And I think it's really important to continually draw the comparison to our current criminal legal system, right? I wish that we kept track of data about whether or not crime survivors are satisfied. We don't. And I think that the amount of complaints we have from crime survivors about our current criminal legal system says a lot. That should tell us enough, right? So the fact that we need a victims' rights movement or a crime survivors' movement at all is indicative of the fact that the system as it currently operates isn't working.
And what's some of the pushback that you might get about this model? What are some of the critiques? What are the reasons why people in decision-making positions wouldn't want to adopt this model?
So I am a lawyer, and I think that when I first started hearing about this, I had attachment to notions like the fair administration of law, or that everything should have everybody gets equal outcomes. If that were true, right? If every single human being who committed X crime got the same punishment, then that would be you know, there might be some merit to the notion of an equal application of the law. But we don't see that in the United States, right? I think that it's those of us who, or anywhere in the world, really. So I don't, I think that there is an importance to honoring the fact that there were some aspirational things in the creation of the criminal legal system as it currently operates, but that we're not seeing those things, we're not making good on those promises, right? So things like proportionality of sentencing, what if the crime survivor wants some huge thing and that why should that person have to do that? Like that everybody doesn't get the same thing, I think makes people nervous. And I would just interrogate whether or not it's important for everybody to get the same thing. Like, everybody's different. Humans are different. They want different things. They have different capacities to take care of different things. So that's one major concern. I think we've also bought the story, and I think it's through our media, that locking people in cages keeps us safe. And when we see from the recidivism data that this is simply not true, right, that incarceration is criminogenic, that it increases the chance that people cause more harm when they get out, is really an important and telling thing. So so a lot of it, you know, a lot of it is based on that. So I think another concern is about the cultural responsiveness of facilitators sometimes too. Like, what does it mean to sort of swoop in and try to do restorative justice in a community you don't know very well? And I think we have seen problems with that. But I do think that these things are ultimately fixable, just because the model itself can be flexible in that way. But, you know, there's some legitimate concerns about the way in which restorative justice can play itself out. I have deep concerns about people who don't have knowledge about underlying subject matters taking on more serious issues like intimate partner and domestic violence, sexual violence. If you aren't knowledgeable and skilled with the underlying subject matter, you really ought not be doing restorative justice as a facilitator in those cases. So I think that's a really legitimate concern that we need to be really thoughtful about.
All right. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing restorative justice with 2019 MacArthur Fellow and Director of the Restorative Justice Project at Impact Justice, Sujatha Balaga. We invite you to call in with questions or comments, and the phone line is open. You can dial 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 to join this conversation. You can also email us with any questions that you might have at cityvisions@kalw.org. And you can tweet us at cityvisionskalw or post a comment on our Facebook page if you want to reach us that way. But we want to hear from you if you've been through the restorative justice process or are interested in the restorative justice process. We'd love to hear your questions and your reflections on that, as well as your general thoughts about how this process might work, maybe in your community. Again, the number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Sujatha, I wanted to ask you about your personal journey into this field of restorative justice. You've been a victim of sexual abuse, including childhood sexual abuse, and I'm interested in how that shaped your journey and maybe motivated your interest in working on this issue.
Absolutely. So, you know, as a child, it's interesting that even as a child, I knew that the systems on offer that in theory were designed to protect me were not what I needed. And if anything, I say that they ensured my silence, right? I did not want my father to be arrested or locked up. I didn't want potential immigration consequences for my family. I didn't want Child Protective Services or, you know, to become involved and potentially remove me from my home and put me in. I was growing up in rural Pennsylvania, where we were the only immigrant family in our town at that time. And I was the only kid of color in my elementary school. I surely didn't want to be put with a family that didn't practice my religion, eat my food, speak my language. And I was quite close to my sister. And I, you know, that was a really huge protective factor for me. So, so I think that I've always been skeptical about the effectiveness of these types of systems that are really dissociated from a direct knowledge of what it is that is happening within a family or a community. And I've always really believed that my family had what was needed in order to heal from that harm. So so I think that, you know, that's a huge part of my personal motivation to find ways for families and communities to heal. We know that survivors of intimate partner violence in particular, 50% don't contact the system at all, don't seek help at all, right? And of those who do, 20% say it made them less safe. So I you know, I think that was something I knew as a kid, and I wasn't interested in engaging any of that for help.
So in other words, the specter of triggering a formal criminal justice process, as you see it, is a major discouraging factor for victims to come forward.
Right.
And that in this process, potentially, if it's available to people, could get more people to, you know, become public with what or public within their circle, right,
yeah,
about what's happened to them.
Child sexual abuse, particularly the secrecy and shame and silence that surrounds this harm, right, and this violence that children live through and families live through is a huge part of what ensures, you know, that keeps it off the radar and ensures that we won't do anything about it, right? And so restorative justice is ultimately about excavating all of that. And so I have great hope that we could be using it in this way. And there's evidence in other countries, right? There's an Ojibwa tribe that in a town called Hollow Water that really effectively applied restorative justice to a pandemic of child sexual abuse in their community, which followed some severe transgenerational trauma that came from the removal of an entire generation of children into boarding schools and where they were sexually and physically abused and then returned, you know, to their community where then they ended up sexually abusing the generation that was, you know, younger than them. And a very deep restorative justice process that happened in that community really put an end to child sexual abuse. There were only two reported cases after 44% of adults were self-reporting sexually abusing children in that community prior to that happening.
Well, and as you mentioned, Native American tribes is here in the United States as well. I've actually done some work with the Hopi tribe on a mediation process for them, and so we have some examples here just within the U.S. borders. Well, we have an email from Jen who asks, is restorative justice being applied in school districts yet? And if so, how? And if not, why not? And I know you mentioned that it is happening in some school districts, but can you elaborate for Jen and others who are interested in what the prospects might be for wider use in school districts?
So restorative justice has been applied in school districts across the nation, but definitely locally here, San Francisco, Oakland, et cetera, to great success. Sadly, defunded over and over and over again. We see the same thing where it took us, you know, a decade in Alameda County, and organizations like Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth and others have done incredible work to get Oakland Unified School District on board. And so it's just the perpetual problem really is prioritizing the funding of restorative justice. It has been shown time and again to reduce truancy, suspensions, expulsions, increase performance, increase teacher retention in schools that have restorative justice. I mean, we see so many positive outcomes from restorative processes. Just school climate in general is radically improved through restorative justice and this beautiful three-tier approach where the primary work in schools is about again, it's like all about creating containers in which beautiful processes can happen, communities are built, and it really just again and again comes back to a matter of funding.
It's the same issue that we were just talking about with the courts where, you know, the money saved is not going to be redirected towards these restorative justice programs?
Right. I mean, I think that one of the things that's hard with school districts is, and I'm of less blame to the districts themselves, right, is that they're put in between, they're put in impossible situations where we pay teachers such substandard wages. We definitely pay, you know, everyone who's involved in this work substandard wages and educating our children and keeping them safe and giving them places to intellectually and emotionally thrive. And so, you know, I think that if we were to, again, redirect the money that we spend on prisons and other, I think, failed methods at keeping us safe towards schools, what a thing that would be.
Well, and on this point of where the money would go, so we've talked about the process of restorative justice. Now, it sounds like you need some pretty skilled, trained facilitators, mediators to engage in this process. Can you describe who these people are and what kinds of training they would need? And just so we have a sense of the resources that would be required to support this kind of a program at a wider scale.
So to do the work that we do with serious offenses in a pre-charge context, there are five trainings that folks go through. First, they start with an implicit bias training, and then circle process training, and then harm circle trainings. And in between each of these trainings, right, there's a period of practice. So you really get the first level of training into in your bones, and you're starting to apply it in your own life and with your own organizations. And then you go on to the next one. So then there's circle training, and then there's harm circle trainings. And then there's a conferencing model model that was adapted from, what Maori people have developed. We call that restorative community conferencing, right? And so we go through all of these trainings together, and then people start to practice it. And so, you know, in other places, so much training might not be needed, right? And I'm always moved by a story I once heard from a friend who works in Chicago, Cheryl Graves, who runs a wonderful organization there, Community Justice for Youth Institute. And they used to give certificates out, and then there was a job for the schools there locally in restorative justice, and a local indigenous woman had applied and didn't get the job, even though she was the top ranked candidate, because she didn't have the certificate she needed. But she grew up practicing restorative justice, right? And so I'm also a little bit skeptical about the notion of like certificating and deciding like who is worthy. And at the same time, you don't want to rush into this work without having some basic understanding of how to hold with equal compassion folks who've caused harm, folks who've experienced harm, and believing in the family and community's capacity to solve this themselves without being a heavy-handed mediator, rather creating, again, opportunities for people to solve this themselves.
All right. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing restorative justice with 2019 MacArthur Fellow Sujatha Balaga. And we invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear your questions or comments about the process of restorative justice and how that can address many of the harms that happen in our communities in the Bay Area and beyond. So again, the number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Sujatha, I wanted to ask about the impact of your faith on this process and your involvement in it. You've been pretty open about that role. Can you describe a bit about your faith and how that influences your work on the subject?
Sure. So I'm Buddhist, and I practice within the Tibetan Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist lineage. When I was 24 years old, I had an opportunity to meet the Dalai Lama when I was really struggling with anger towards my father for the sexual abuse that I endured in my childhood. My father had passed away when I was 16, and I was never going to get to have a restorative justice process with him. And this was long before I even knew what those words really were. And I'd had sort of partial accountability conversations with him where we really didn't get to the finish line on it. And so I harbored a lot of anger and hatred towards my father. And through this dialogue with His Holiness, I came to see the possibility of forgiveness in my own sort of heart in relationship to my father, and ultimately following His Holiness's advice, was able to put the practices into place that he'd suggested to me that allowed me to forgive my father just a few months later. And after that, I was about to go to law school to become a prosecutor, where I thought I was going to, lock up the bad guys, particularly people who'd cause sexual harm. And I had a real change of heart and ultimately ended up becoming a defense attorney. Through all of that, really deepening my own curiosity about Buddhism. And I actually just read and studied and meditated and went to different meditation courses over the course of 12 years, really testing out the religion, just like the Buddha says, and we should really not accept it wholesale and really test it ourselves. And so I took that quite seriously and ultimately took refuge and became a Buddhist. And today I see a lot of what my interest was back then and shortly after law school in the Tibetan system of justice prior to Chinese occupation, with notions of the possibility of people sort of reconciling based on a shared understanding of what needs to happen to set this thing right, that really was also restorative justice. And I can see how these principles of compassion and understanding and empathy and repair and making things right really exist as parts of Tibetan Buddhist practice really are undergird at what the system of justice in Tibet had been prior to Chinese occupation.
And do you see this restorative justice process as a religious one in some ways?
So for me, it's really important for us to be secular, right? Growing up in rural Pennsylvania, where there was often a blurring of church and state, and it was definitely problematic to be a religious minority. I grew up Hindu and was really mistreated, not just on the basis of race, but also primarily on the basis of religion. I think it's incredibly important that we keep these things separate. What I notice in myself is that my own Buddhist practice gives me the strength that I need in order to sit in the fire of some of these harder conversations that can happen in restorative justice processes and in the implementation work, you know, that these the wellsprings of compassion and loving kindness and a belief in the Buddha nature of everyone, right? These are things that really are at the center of my ability to do this work. I don't voice that publicly, nor do I expect anyone to agree with me in any way. But surely it is at the root of what it is that I do, of what I am able to do.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left, so I wanted to ask about kind of next steps here and what you see on the horizon. So for the Restorative Justice Project, what's sort of on tap here?
So Ashley George, again, my associate director, and Alex Bizansky have been doing an incredible job. Alex Bizansky is the president of Impact Justice, and they're just doing an amazing job of leading this youth diversion work, which I'm stepping back from. And I see our work, you know, really is trying to grow the number of jurisdictions that this is available in nationally.
What are some of your prime targets here?
You know, I want to just not say, because I think sometimes it's a politically touchy thing for a lot of district attorneys that we speak with, and that we want to make sure that their positions and their elections and their, you know, are secured and allow them to sort of announce where
it's
it is.
It's safe to say nationwide.
Nationwide, we would love to see a huge pilot project, in a sense. Or I don't know if we even want to call it a pilot, like second phase, where we have, you know, many, many jurisdictions working together, and that we're keeping track of the data to show how much more effective this is. That this isn't a one-off weirdo thing that's happening in the Bay Area, but that the data is going to prove to be true in Miami and Philly and in Nashville and many, many other places across the South, you know, in the Midwest. Like, where could we see this happen? So that feels really important. And we're also growing our wisdom and knowledge about how to apply this in intimate partner and sexual violence in safe ways, in ways that are in deep relationship with long-standing organizations that have been working to end intimate partner and sexual violence. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We want to see folks bring the wisdom that they know about safety and accountability from those contexts into the work of restorative justice, and to do deep partnerships on that front. So that's really exciting as well.
And very quickly, we do have a caller, Ariana from San Francisco. I want to give her a chance to ask a question. Ariana, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Yeah, kind of two parts. One is how can, I think it's fantastic. How can we help promote it? And then the other is the criminal justice system opposing it because they're so invested in the status quo?
All right. Thank you, Ariana, for those questions. So, Sujatha?
Well, I think that they're related in a sense, right? So as much as folks want to rabble-rouse and get their local elected folks to really get behind this, I think it's really important. I think that, you know, whatever legislation could exist at the state level to direct funding towards restorative justice, but in a way that circumvents the criminal legal system, right? We want to be really careful about state legislation and making sure that it doesn't do anything to limit application to, you know, post-charge or in prison programs or low-level crimes, right? We want to see it happen with felonies. We want to see it happen pre-charge in a way, because we're seeing the data proves it. And I think that, you know, wherever it is that you see yourself getting plugged into this, what are the gifts and skills that you bring in your community to be bringing circle process to your churches, to your schools, to your, you know, that's a really beautiful thing that can be done as well. So,
and opportunities for people to get trainings to become a restorative justice
absolutely.
Facilitator?
Absolutely. You know, and I think we're going to be launching our National Training and Technical Institute, ideally in 2020, possibly 2021, really just bringing it online and giving more people opportunity to learn how to do restorative justice themselves in their own spaces and worlds. But there are tons of people offering trainings statewide in restorative justice and nationally. So tap into your local community and see where it is that you can plug yourself in, because it really takes all of us. It doesn't take lawyers and professionals. And if anything, we have to take that hat off in order to not be trying to fix other people, but believe in people's ability to really heal their own stuff.
All right. Well, I want to thank Ariana for that question, but more importantly, I want to thank you, Sujatha, for coming on. That's City Visions for this evening. And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But my guest tonight was Sujatha Balaga, 2019 MacArthur Fellow and Director of the Restorative Justice Project at Impact Justice. Thanks so much for joining us and for this conversation.
Thank you.
And for a link to this and other City Vision shows, and to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, you can visit our City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next week for another discussion on City Visions here Monday nights at 7 o'clock. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.